Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Mick Clifford podcast of the Irish Examiner. Now, one of the longest running scandals in the last half century of this state's existence has been the plight of the families of those who died in the Stardust fire in 1981. On Thursday, a conclusion of sorts was reached in their journey when an inquest returned a verdict of unlawful killing in the deaths of all the 48 young people who had died. The fire occurred in the Stardust complex in Artane in Dublin. Most of the deceased had come from the area around Artane, Killester and Coolock. And the event traumatised whole communities and not just the bereaved families whose lives were quite obviously devastated. But what really piled anger on heartache was how the state reacted. A tribunal was quickly set up and that reached a conclusion that arson was the probable cause of the fire, even though there was no evidence of it. The basis for that conclusion was, as I say, highly suspect, and certainly the families felt it laid the blame at the door of the local communities and, one could say, let the owner off the hook. The owner of the complex in turn received over £400,000 in compensation on the basis that arson was the probable cause of the fire. That has long been disproven, but the inquest was the chance after all these years for the truth to finally emerge. Irish Examiner reporter Sean Murray has been following the long fight for justice, followed by the families for most of his career, and Sean joins me now. Sean, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Mick. Thanks for having me.
Sean, we journalists are supposed to be professionally dispassionate, but you were down there today, and as I say, you followed this for years, and I can't but imagine it was a highly emotional time when those verdicts came back.
Like I think I've been a journalist just under 10 years. I think I could be a journalist for another 30 or 40 years and I'll never experience a day like today. The emotion in the room, the raw energy in the room, these were verdicts that were 40 years in the making, as you outlined at the start. Families who had originally been told it was probably arson, it was probably one of their own that did it. This kind of working class community being told that and having to fight tooth and nail at every stage to get to the point where they got today. It was humbling to see it. It was so emotional, like the way it was delivered when the jury foreman, he was asked what verdicts they had reached. And he just said those two words, unlawful killing. And in unison, everyone in the room jumped up, screaming, shouting, crying. Like amidst the din, I just heard one man say, at long last, during it. It was a humbling thing to experience. And I don't think anyone who was in that room will ever forget being there today.
Yes, I can well imagine. And of course, in relation to the families, what comes across, and there's a whole range of aspects to this, particularly the conduct of various arms of the state, and one can say the culture and the type of country we were living in, certainly back in 1981. But the overarching element to it is the persistence of the families to get, as they saw it, justice for those who had died.
Yeah, like it's been such a long road. I remember during the closing submissions when the council for the families were putting forth their stall, as it were, to say that it was unlawful killing. It was Michael O'Higgins, senior counsel, who people are probably familiar with. He's very, very, very prolific down the courts in very high profile cases. He was representing some of the families. And he said, the reason we're here today is women. Women possessed of indomitable spirit. Women who would not be broken, who would not waver, who would not stop. And these were the mothers and the sisters of the Stardust victims, people like Gertrude Barrett, who lost her son Michael. She was there every single day of the inquests, having fought for so long. We had Antoinette Keegan, who went to the Stardust that night with two of her sisters, who sadly passed away while she managed to escape. There was Bridget McDermott, who's now in her 80s, who has been part of this campaign for so long. She wanted to know what happened to her three children and that's three children who died in the Stardust: William, George, and Marcella. So many people have played a role to get to today, but it was really that kind of strength of spirit of the families to never say die, even when they came up against, as you say, the arms of the state that would say, no, we can't do anything for you. They would go off again. They would find new means. They would try and find a new method. And it's a testament to all of them that they made it to where they got to today.
Yeah, and I was a teenager myself, Sean, when it happened. And, you know, I've obviously at the time it was a massive thing in the country, and even when I became joined a journalist and I checked in out at various times, and I have to say, and I don't know how typical this is, but there were times when I saw what they were doing and I had sympathy for them, but I had to say I thought it ain't going to go somewhere, unfortunately, because they kept being knocked back, and that more than anything I think is testament to what drove it on. And as you said, women, and the big thing there is that this originated in a state where women were in a lot of different ways second class citizens, and it was a real patriarchal society. And yet, okay, times have changed very much since then, but for it to come out being led by women, I think is pretty significant as well. I want to go back into the whole thing because quite obviously it's so long ago a lot of people mightn't be familiar with it, Sean. But just before we do that, a couple of things just to close off. One, it was only announced after the verdict, or it became known and it was allowed to be reported, was that the man who's the manager of the Stardust and whose family owned the complex, Eamon Butterley, he went to the High Court, I think it was twice, attempting to ensure get the courts to not allow that the inquest return with a verdict of unlawful killing.
Yeah, that's correct. So prior to the inquest even getting underway, which got underway a year ago, next week, prior to that, Eamon Butterley had taken a judicial review to try and bar the coroner from allowing unlawful killing to be considered by the jury. The kind of things that he argued were under the kind of rules and laws governing inquests, you can't find anyone to blame for a death, or you can't exonerate someone. You can't find anyone criminally or civilly liable at an inquest, which is quite crucial, and that law has to be respected at every kind of inquest. He argued that an unlawful killing verdict would necessarily point the finger at him, or would highlight him, would identify him, and he took a judicial review in 2022 that failed at that time before the inquest got underway. But at the very end of the proceedings, almost at the very end, just before the jury were charged and sent out to go consider their verdicts, his legal team tried again. They sought leave to take another judicial review last month, again with the same objective in mind, to not allow the jury consider unlawful killing when they were considering their verdicts. And he was not granted leave at that stage, over a year in to the process to try and prevent unlawful killing, because if he'd been granted leave to take that judicial review, obviously we wouldn't be talking today. This judicial review would probably be dragging on quite a lot, because these things in the courts generally do. So because he wasn't successful in those bids, that's why we were able to get to the point that we're at today.
Yeah, and the notion that there can't be an unlawful killing verdict, you can see why a court would find that very questionable, because that is the case very often in juries, in inquests, that there is an unlawful killing verdict. But the crucial element being that the jury does not in any direct way find an individual or entity responsible for it, because that's not their function. Their function is to determine what actually went on. So the idea that you couldn't have an unlawful killing verdict would seem to be stretching it somewhat. Of course, the other thing that arises there is that should Mr. Butterley feel in any way that his reputation or whatever is impacted, he may well decide to challenge the verdict as it was. But one way or the other, the verdict does not directly implicate him in anything. It just states that it's unlawful killing.
Exactly. Like the coroner could not have been clearer in her many directions to the jury on this point. She said that this process is not about casting blame. It's not about finding someone responsible for these deaths. It's about inquiring into the circumstances around them. And to help the jury make their verdicts, she designed two questionnaires. One of the questionnaires was specific to each person to determine the medical cause of death and ultimately the verdict. But then there was a general questionnaire which asked questions like surrounding the situation in the club on the night. There were things like if the carpet tiles on the walls, which were a huge factor in the inquest, if the carpet tiles on the walls played a role in the spread of the fire. There was also aspects of the polyurethane foam in the seating, very specific things. Did they contribute to the fire? There's no mention of names in this questionnaire. There's no mention of casting blame. It's a simple yes or no. Did this contribute? And that was the process that the coroner followed.
Right. And just going back to the detail, you mentioned carpet tiles on the walls, which was a very crucial aspect. But just touching on some of that before we come to the family's journey, the history of the Stardust. The Butterley family, I think they were originally involved in agriculture up around North County Dublin, that they bought the complex. It was formerly a food factory. At some point, Eamon Butterley's father, Patrick, converted it into an entertainment centre, right there around the late 70s. Eamon Butterley was put in charge of it. It seems that Eamon Butterley was put in charge of converting it, and he had no experience in project management or construction or anything like that. He was subsequently put in charge of managing it, and he had no experience in that area either. It was simply that he was in the family and this was a family business. But there were crucial aspects, Sean, in relation to the carpet tiles on the wall, for one thing. Tell us about that. Sorry, I suppose I should point out to people. It was a venue. There's bands like The Specials. People might know them. Were there, I think, enduring the Blockheads, big country acts, a lot of people, that kind of thing, could hold up to 800. There'd been a bit of controversy a few months beforehand. I think it was when The Specials were there, when there was up to 2,000 people in there. There had been warnings from Dublin City Council about the way the place was managed and their opinion in relation to fire safety and that. But in terms of the carpet tiles on the wall, tell us about them.
Yeah, so this is going back to when the building was being converted. As you said, it was a factory and it was being converted into an entertainment complex. They were torn down for planning permission several times before they actually got to the stage where they were allowed to build it. And one of the issues was is that there were two men at various stages who were enlisted to kind of draw up the plans for the Stardust, but neither of them had any architectural qualifications to speak of. They worked in the industry, but they didn't have full qualifications in that. To turn to the carpet tiles, one of the conditions of the planning permission was that they had to have wall coverings of a certain flame retardant standard. I won't get too technical, but that's what it is, a certain standard of flame retardant. The carpet tiles that were put on the walls were not to that standard. The certificate they got to show that it was of the standard was for carpets on the floor, not for on the walls. And obviously, I'm sure people can imagine what happened when the fire happened. The fire was first spotted on some seats, and then it traveled to the wall where the carpet was. And because of the makeup of those carpet tiles, that rapidly spread throughout the ballroom. That after that, an expert said afterwards that if the carpet tiles hadn't been there, if there'd been wall coverings of a different kind, the fire might not have spread the way it did at all.
Yeah, and one thing I found shocking was the fact that we're talking about from when the fire was first spotted, which presumably was within has to be within a minute of it igniting, until the worst of the damage was done. You're talking only about 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's kind of frightening to imagine the scale of that. So what the jury found today was that they concluded that the fire had started in the hot press in the main bar, and it was due to an electrical fault. So what we heard in evidence at the inquest is when this electrical fault happened, it obviously started a small fire that then spread to, it was a tiered off section of the nightclub that they called the West Alcove. So usually they would have it open on disco nights, but they actually opened the opposite one, the North Alcove, that night and had this kind of closed off. People started to see, because there was curtain separating, and people started to see through the curtain and saw that there was a small fire there. And that was the thing during the evidence, even all these years later, that really stuck with me when I was listening. Everyone was just saying it's quite small at the start. They thought it could be put under control easily. But again, when we heard from the experts, they said once the flames hit those carpet tiles on the walls and then spread to the ceiling, like the conditions in the Stardust became untenable for human life within just a couple of minutes. And it could have been the difference between you seeing the small fire and going to get your coat wherever it was, or going to get your handbag wherever it was. You might not have had the time between seeing that to getting the coat and then getting out. Like that, we're talking, that's how quickly it was. And so by the time the forest fire engines arrived, like 10 minutes after the forest emergency services call, like within they got there within 10 minutes. By that time, I'm sorry to say that the people there were, most of them who had passed away were already deceased, because that's how quick it was. There was no chance to save a lot of the people.
And there was two, I think, though, and you correct me, Sean, because you're more intimate with the facts, but two elements that struck me as being very crucial. One was the state of the six exits that were designed for the main function room there that the Stardust was in, and some of them worked, but some of them didn't. And the other element, and I found this particularly harrowing, a number of people went into the bathroom and the bathroom windows couldn't be opened because they'd been secured on the basis that management had thought that people previously were throwing in drink and other various things. Am I correct in that?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, like that's one of the things when you're talking to people about the Stardust and you explain about the situation with the doors and then the bars on the windows, it really takes people's breath away. Like just to touch on the bars on the windows first, these were massive steel plates erected at the windows. So I think the suggestion had been, like, some of the lads, because you had to wear a tie to get into the Stardust. That was the thing. The bouncer turned the lads away if they weren't wearing a tie. And the amount of ones who said, I'd go in wearing a tie and I'd pass it out to my mate who was outside, and they put the tie on and be able to get in. It seemed to be some suggestion that there was like drink being passed in or weapons being passed in. There was very little to back up the claim of the weapons. But again, like I think anyone listening will have seen a drink being smuggled into nightclubs. That's a well-known facet of what goes on in nightlife in this country.
The most harmless thing, yeah.
Yeah. And then just to turn to the doors, like, I mean, it was an established practice at the Stardust that some of the emergency exit doors on disco nights would be kept locked at the start of the night when the public were on the premises. So they would be chained and locked. And the idea behind that was that apparently some of the patrons who would go in would go and open the emergency exits and let their friends in without paying. Now, this was a narrative that has been stuck around for a very long time. And obviously, if the bouncers stationed at each one of those exits, that would have gotten rid of the need for the chains and the locks, or if you could even call it a need at all, because having those chains and locks on the doors broke the bylaws for Dublin City, because you couldn't have doors chained while public were on the premises. And it's been one of those kind of clouds lingering over the Stardust for so long, where those doors locked at the time of the fire. The management and the bouncers at the Stardust said, yeah, they're all open. Yep, we had them open, where the witness evidence points to severe difficulties in getting out those doors, particularly exits 3, which was behind the stage, and then 4 and 5, which were either side of a small bar. And what they were able to show at the inquest, which is very interesting, because they also had a practice at the Stardust of even when they would unlock the chains, even when they would take the padlocks off, they would drape the chains around the lock as if to make it seem as if locked. And what the evidence heard is that if those chains are draped over, even if not like locked with a padlock, if you tried to push them, sometimes they would jam. And so in a situation of panic when people are trying to get out of a nightclub, and if a door is jamming, I'm sure you could imagine it could be nearly as bad as being locked in and of itself. And one door in particular, exit 3, was absolutely kicked in, and the pictures afterwards show that it looked like it was locked at the time.
Oh, and in fairness, the First Tribunal, the original one, made note of some of the very dangerous and shabby practices that were in place at the time. And it also has to be said that Dublin City Council had written to them over concerns previously. Now, an issue there, and an issue that's been there not just then but many times since, is what quality of enforcement was followed up on that. But that's for the council. But
even on that point, like you were talking about the specialist concert that was way oversubscribed, the month before the Stardust, and Dublin City Council had an inspector there. He was an electrical inspector, and every time he went to Stardust, he kind of went above his remit, because he would look at the exit doors and he would look at various different things. And like after that night, they the Dublin City Council, or Dublin Corporation as it was at the time, wrote to the Butterleys and said, here, look, you need to keep doors unobstructed, etc., etc., or we might appear at your next licensing hearing. There was no threat of shutting them down or anything like that. It was just, we might appear at your next licensing hearing. And then Eamon Butterley wrote back to say he took personal care to make sure that the exits were kept unobstructed at all times, which as we know, on the night, people had very great difficulty getting out those doors.
Yeah, two things arise there, Sean. One of the things that arose out of the Stardust, and the major shortcomings that were shown there in design features more than the actual management of it, and that was it was the beginning of the establishment of proper fire safety regulations in the state, initially through Dublin Corporation and then statewide. And in turn, that showed during the years of the Celtic Tiger to be extremely deficient in how it was enforced and practiced. And we currently have a scheme set up that's going to cost 3 or 4 billion to recompense people who've been rightly recompensed, them who bought apartments that were not, that didn't have proper fire safety and were not inspected as a result. That's all a separate story. The other thing that arises is that what you're talking about there and what this inquest has heard, a huge amount of it was heard in the initial tribunal, which was chaired by Judge Ronan Keane, who went on to be the Chief Justice. He chaired that tribunal. Most of that evidence was heard there. Now, he did find that the practices were not as they should have been and that some of them were very dangerous. But he also came to that conclusion that it was probably started by arson, despite, he even said, the fact that there was no specific evidence of that. That really, I think, is at the heart of an awful lot that didn't allow the families have closure at that point.
Yeah, 100%. Like the Keane report goes on for over 600 pages, and I have sat through and I have read it. And in many ways, it's meticulous. It's in depth and it's detailed, and it pulls no punches in terms of calling out shortcomings that it finds. We were talking about the Butterleys being castigated for some of those practices, which is contained in the Keane report. So for it to reach the conclusion that it did is somewhat surprising when you're reading it, because of, like he says in the report, the cause of the fire is not known and may never be known. As a kind of preface to the chapter, which starts with probable arson as its conclusion, which is very, very surprising. And it's obviously something that the families have long railed against. It's essentially one of their, being told that one of your own from this North Dublin community who was there on the night started this fire, it's something that they couldn't ever accept. And why could they? Because the evidence wasn't there to back that up. In the wake of the Stardust, the Gardaí interviewed over 1,000 witnesses. They interviewed everyone who was even mildly related to the Stardust, and they couldn't conclude that it was arson. And for the tribunal to conclude that was something that the families, is something that they could never accept, they could never move on from. And it's one of the reasons why we were here today, because they feel in this unlawful killing verdict, they've gotten the justice and truth that they should have had a long time ago.
Absolutely. And one of the outcomes from that original tribunal was that on the basis there was probable arson, the Butterley family were able to sue Dublin's corporation, as it was, for a malicious fire. They were, I don't know, was it awarded or settled for something just south of £500,000. We're talking about the equivalent of maybe €700,000-€800,000 in today's money, and you can throw a multiple on that in terms of what the value of it at the time. The other element to that is that in terms of any compensation fund for the bereaved and the injured, and some people suffered horrific injuries, that took another few years to even get off the ground, and it required constant petitioning and hassle at the government in order to do that. And that kind of juxtaposition, Sean, to me anyway, speaks volumes about perhaps where priorities were in society and what have you at the time.
Yeah, like I think when the Keane Tribunal's report came in, like I think the way that the Irish state works a lot of time is that when they commission something as large as a tribunal of inquiry, they want that to be the final word. Like, we've had tribunals of inquiry on many different things before, and we might not hear too much about it afterwards. And I think they wanted that to be the final word. But then, because of the dissatisfaction with the answers from the families, they had to pursue legal cases themselves, because they weren't compensated for the deaths of their loved ones in that fire. And they had to sue the corporation in the same way that the Bortleys had to sue the corporation. And so a kind of hodgepodge that was put together at the time by the government of the day in the mid-80s was to set up a compensation tribunal, where the proviso was, if you sign up to our scheme where you will get a few bob, you have to give up your legal cases. Now, I remember being very interested when some state papers were released from that time, just a few years ago, from the office of An Taoiseach at the time, on Gareth Fitzgerald, a memo sent to Justice said they wanted to be kept away from it. And it was one of those where, okay, the Stardust families are asking for X, Y, and Z. We'll try and give them this, and then hope that this, we can close the chapter on this, because we want to close the chapter on this and move on. And it was something that the families, to their eternal credit, would never give up on.
Yeah, it says an awful lot about the nature of society at the time there. And, you know, it has often been posited, and I think with some validity, was the fact that the vast majority of these people were from working class communities in the north side of Dublin. Did that feed into the overall attitudes within the state apparatus in terms of how to properly deal with the matter and how to properly approach people who've been put through this awful trauma? And I think it's fair to say a lot of people would suggest a lot to do with it.
I remember the late great Charlie Board. I spoke to him a few times about the Stardust and about his support for the Stardust. And he always had a refrain that if it happened in Donnybrook rather than Bonnybrook, this would have all been sorted a long time ago. If it happened in leafy South Dublin rather than the working class area of Artane, this all would have been sorted, because I think there's that perception that, okay, yeah, we can ignore the working classes. They're not the ones who vote for us. They're not the ones who keep us in government. That was definitely, whether true or not, it does seem to be the case that has been for so long. It's like, it's kind of similar to Hillsborough in the UK, where the working class Liverpool fans were castigated and told that they'd caused that horrible tragedy themselves. It was similar to Stardust. They felt they'd been told they caused this tragedy themselves. And it just added to the trauma and the pain over the years as well, to try and get that specific kind of claim thrown out.
Absolutely. No, and then just the journey itself in legal terms, Sean, obviously the families pushed for a long time for a public inquiry, which they were perfectly right in doing so. And I think they had excellent grounds for doing so. But just bring us through, if you briefly, that kind of progression. They were searching for the public inquiry. What happened and how did we end up with an inquest?
Yeah, so you said briefly, but it might not be so brief, because it was such a long road. So yeah, in the mid-2000s, it really started to pick up pace again. The kind of, we need to find out what happened here. We need to get to the bottom of this once and for all. We need to look at every avenue to get the answers that we've so long sought. The government of the day relented and ordered the coffee inquiry, which took several years to come back.
And Paul Coffey, a senior counsel.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and he examined the evidence that they'd gathered, and he had a look at all of the facets of that. Now, he made one crucial recommendation, which was a major milestone for the families, and that was that the arson finding should be struck from the record, and that was struck from the Dáil record in 2009. That was obviously a major milestone, which shouldn't be underestimated, because that was a claim that had been laid against them for over 25 years at that point. So to expunge that from the record was a key was a key win for the Stardust families, but crucially, it didn't recommend a new inquiry. So what did they do? They go plan afresh, they go look afresh, and then it took another few years, and then a retired judge was asked to also take a look at what they'd gathered. This was Pat McCartan. And in 2017, he said that there was no reason to order a new inquiry. There was no grounds to order a fresh inquiry. So at that point...
Just to stop you there, one second, Sean, just because Pat McCartan's an interesting character in himself, and I know the family were disappointed with what he came back with, but I would have to say, in terms of the man himself, I couldn't imagine him being anything other than completely fair, but even more to the point, completely cognizant of a situation whereby something that required inquiry going back from those times was needed, for the simple reason that Pat McCartan was a solicitor to a number of men who were arrested and by all accounts assaulted in custody over the Salins mail train robbery in 1976. And that was another scandal of a different nature to the Stardust, obviously, but one in which the whole criminal justice system, including Gardaí and the judiciary and all, had major questions to answer. And that has never been addressed. So I can very much see why McCartan would have been somebody who would certainly have empathy with what was going on. And I would have to say that, notwithstanding the disappointment of the families, I'd be very confident that within his brief, he did everything possible and was as fair as possible.
Yeah, like I think after that knockback, I think it was the kind of spore they needed to be like, okay, you know, we've called for new inquiries, we failed at that. And then around the same time, a lot of the families became involved with Dara Mackin, who is a solicitor with Phoenix Law based in Northern Ireland, who deal with a lot of legacy cases up there and are very experienced in participating in those kind of cases up there. And Dara Mackin was definitely a sea change in this journey, because he took a look at the case, obviously felt very sympathetic towards the families and could see the very strong case they had for this to be reopened again. And he had a look, and he's seen that the original inquests for the people who died in the Stardust, the 48 who died in 1982, they were very small. They just literally recorded the medical cause of death without looking at the wider circumstances around that death, which is like possible and is encouraged under the 1962 Coroner's Act to investigate the circumstances of a death. So he identified inquests as the main way to go, because he looked at the original 1982 inquests and saw that it only really looked into the medical cause of death for the 48 people who died in the Stardust. Of course, under the 1962 Coroner's Act, an inquest can inquire into the circumstances around a death as well. And he said, OK, we failed in the bids to get in new inquiries, but I think we can point to the insufficiency of inquiry at these inquests in 1982 to push the case to get these new fresh inquests. And it was those words, insufficiency of inquiry, that were used by the Attorney General when he finally granted them in 2019. And this was after a long campaign where Stardust families had gone up and down the country getting people to sign postcards. They delivered 48,000 postcards to the Office of the Attorney General to show the public desire and support for justice for these families, for this to get looked at again. And it was that switch with Dara Mackin to look for fresh inquests, which was the impetus to get us to the process that we've now been going through over the last year.
Yeah, there's no question in the world, Dara Mackin and his reputation he for human rights cases, and he was central to the whole thing. I heard Finian McGrath earlier, who's a junior minister in the coalition government 2016-2020. He was an independent TD, and he was from that North Dublin area. The Stardust was in his constituency, and he'd liaised with the families for years. And I just found it interesting. He said in his dealings with the then Attorney General Seamus Wolfe that he found Wolfe very receptive to that idea. Seamus Wolfe, of course, became a controversial figure after he was appointed to the Supreme Court when he was attended Golfgate, as we call it, the story broken by the Irish Examiner, all these the great and the good over in the west of Ireland during the lockdown. But Finian McGrath was singing his praise in that respect of how he had dealt with it. But as you say, then we got to the inquest. The families were there throughout the inquest.
Yeah, they were like some of the families were there every single day. Gertrude Barrett, who I mentioned earlier on, who lost her son Michael, she was there every single day, and so was Samantha Mangan, whose mother Helena died in the Stardust. She was there every single day for her mother. You get to, you see these people all the time. You get to know them. They're just lovely, genuine people, and you kind of couldn't help but feel like you wanted to see them get the answers that they'd sought for so long. There was the McHughes, Morris and Phyllis McHugh, who lost their only child, Caroline, in the Stardust. I could name off a string of people that were there every single day. But they were attentive. They sat through the hard evidence. They sat through the difficult evidence. And they also sat through the uplifting evidence of people going in to help others, of the firemen who bravely rushed into the Stardust and were able to save several people. It was a humbling experience because I was there for many of those days, and it was a really humbling experience to be there and to witness that kind of that justice being done over the course of that long year.
Absolutely. And of course, the other thing is the as we say, because it is 43 years, and particularly parents who would have been, you know, we're talking about teenagers, early 20s, parents would have been possibly in their 40s, possibly into their 50s at that stage and what have you. And an awful lot of them, unfortunately, never got to see this day. They died in the interim. And of course, they also should be remembered on an occasion like this. Sean, I suppose just to finish, is there a follow on to this extent? If a finding of unlawful killing has been made, does that get referred to the DPP to see whether anything should be pursued in the criminal justice system, or does it just stand there alone?
I think the families today were keen to kind of downplay the next steps, as it were. Like, they were seeing today as truth and justice in and of itself after such a long journey. They were also seeking a public apology from the Irish state over how they've been treated over the years. But as you say, yeah, like that it's not an automatic thing that a verdict of unlawful killing is referred to the DPP, but it is something that could potentially happen. There's also the potential for maybe civil cases in the future. I'd be very skeptical of any of those kind of advancing in the short or medium term. However, I think today is just such a significant day for the families and for the loved ones of those who passed away. I think if there may be future chapters to write, but I think we'll be waiting a while till we hear what they are just yet.
I think you're absolutely right. Sean, we had you before on the pod in the course of the inquest, and thank you very much for your reporting. First class. And I would just say to anybody, Sean's work, and it'll be quite extensive, you can read in the Irish Examiner and on irishexaminer.com. Some very incisive reporting to be seen there over what is one, as I say, one of the biggest scandals we've experienced in the last half century in this state. Sean, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mick.
I'd like to thank our engineer, Jim Coughlin, as well. Thank you, folks, for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Take it easy.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.